This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. So for most of us, making a very deliberate effort to be happy can have just the opposite effect. Trying to get to that state of contentedness can just magnify our own anxiety and unease. So what if you try taking a negative path to happiness? Could that be the key? My guest, Oliver Berkman, has been thinking a lot about this and writing about the happiness industry in his new book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. Oliver Berkman, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
So I'm going to have you start with what you start with in the book, which is a very striking image of Robert Schuller, who many people know. He's a pastor, but he's also a sort of self-help guru, and he's teaching people to be happy. And you're at this enormous seminar where, by the way, George W. Bush puts in an appearance. So tell me a little bit about this seminar and what led you to go.
Well, this was a seminar, part of a series called Get Motivated, which has an exclamation point in its name. It was many thousands of people in a basketball stadium in San Antonio in Texas. And what Robert Schuller told us that day was that if we wanted to succeed, all we needed to do was to eliminate the word impossible from our vocabularies. And that was very much the message that you got all the way through this. And it's a big part of the positive thinking culture that is so dominant in a lot of American, British business and society at large. That if you really, really focus only on success, that's the way to get it.
Now, when you talked to the people who were sitting around you or sort of milled around, did people seem to be buying it, or were they like, well, this isn't quite measuring up to my expectations?
Well, the atmosphere was pretty high and sort of psyched up. And, even as a British person who doesn't leap out of chairs with excitement, I caught a little bit of it. There was a little bit of sarcasm going on as well, and around the edges, I think.
So now, how does somebody like Robert Schuller, who, like you said, they have this program, Get Motivated, with an exclamation point, how does he get George W. Bush, but not just George W. Bush, Colin Powell, Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, these people are regulars at his seminars.
Well, it's not actually him who's running it. He's another speaker. But yes, how do they get them is just as good a question. And I think, the answer is that they pay them good money to appear. Although it's an interesting and telling detail, actually, that since this book went to the printers, I believe that Get Motivated itself has, I think I'm right to say, has filed for bankruptcy. So there appear to be problems afoot anyway in this sort of industry of relentless positivity.
But you saw people from all different walks of life, from the National Park Service, from the U.S. military, mm-hmm. all who were there to sort of soak up what Schuller had to offer.
Right, and to soak up what the other speakers had to offer, this idea that if you really, really focus and you get people in that room focused on feeling positive and feeling great, then, it's going to last and it's going to be the answer to their problems. But of course, if you talked, there were many service personnel in the audience. But of course, if you talk to a military person about whether ignoring the possibility of failure is the right way to plan a military operation, they will say, of course not. You've got to think about failure. You've got to turn towards those more problematic emotions and situations.
No, but so I'm going to push back on that with a quote from George W. Bush at the Schuller event, who says, quote, "I don't believe you can lead a family or a school or a city or a state or a country unless you're optimistic that the future is going to be better." So what's wrong with that sort of just incredible, undying optimism? And he said, basically, throughout my whole presidency, no matter what was happening, I was always optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is it's circular logic, right? So when something went well for him in his presidency, he would conclude that it was right that he was optimistic. When things were going badly, he would conclude that what he needed was more optimism. So it's sort of a closed system that means you never get to analyze the possibility that things might not be, you might not be approaching things in the right way. And, I think there were obviously many people who would argue that his presidency didn't approach lots of things in the right way.
So how did you come to be at this Schuller seminar? What led you to – I'm assuming you weren't there to actually get motivated, but maybe you were. So why were you there, and what led you to be so interested in the happiness industry?
Well, I had for some years been writing a column in the Guardian newspaper about psychology, self-help, trying to take a skeptical viewpoint, but not a cynical one, because I think that, if I am honest and other people are honest, we do sort of want a lot of the things that these books promise. I think most of them are quite poor at delivering, but the urge to find greater happiness, more productivity, whatever it may be, is a very noble one, I think. So I had gone off to explore, really to explore the idea that there might be an alternative to this dominant message. But at the beginning, as you say, I first of all thought I better examine this positivity culture, you know, at its most extreme level. Then what I try to do in the rest of the book is turn towards the something that might be more fruitful.
Yeah, and you talk about new research on how you can maybe not engage in positive thinking, but still end up with a positive result. But first, I want to play you a little clip of a speaker that you mentioned, Brian Tracy, who's a self-help, you know, talker, a guru. He says that what's really important, and this is not just limited to him, it's really important to control your thinking, to have very specific goals. Let's listen to Brian Tracy.
The true measure of mental fitness is how optimistic you are about yourself and your life. Now, in order to become truly optimistic, you must learn how to control your thinking in very specific ways so that you feel terrific about yourself and your situation most of the time, no matter what happens.
Now, Oliver Berkman, you were very excited while we were playing this clip. So what is wrong with the notion of if you imagine it, if you believe it, it can happen to you?
In a whole lot of different ways, there seems to be something about the human mind such that when you really focus on having a certain thought, it has the opposite effect. This all goes back to the old parlor game where you say to someone, can you not think about a polar bear for a whole minute? And of course, when you try to do that, all you can think about is polar bears. And that pattern repeats itself in all sorts of psychological studies. People who suffer from bereavement and then try not to feel grief take a longer time to recover from their grief. People who try to visualize their goals being successfully achieved under certain conditions are less likely to achieve them. People who say, if you say affirmations to yourself, you know, those phrases that are supposed to make you feel happy and successful, people with low self-esteem, according to some studies, end up feeling worse when they've said those. So over and over again, you get this problem that if you really try to aim directly at happiness and positivity, the effort is actually a very stressful one, not a happy one, and it backfires.
Hmm. So then why is the self-help industry so big in the U.S.? I mean, you go to a bookstore or, you know, go type in self-help on Amazon and you're going to find a lot of books. People are making, as you indicated with the Schuller event, a lot of money speaking about this, writing about this. Why is it so big if it doesn't seem to work?
Well, two things to say. Firstly, I don't think that the whole idea of self-help is a terrible one. And I accept that sometimes my book gets shelved in that section as well, depending on the bookstore. Go back to ancient Greece and Rome and philosophy. The practice of philosophy was a self-help undertaking. I think the problem with positive thinking specifically, which is the sort of ideology that underlies a lot of successful self-help, is it has this circular thing. If you bought a TV from a manufacturer and it didn't work, and then you bought another from that manufacturer and it didn't work, you'd probably never buy another TV from that manufacturer. But with positive thinking, if you get it wrong and it doesn't work, it's very tempting to conclude that it's because you weren't thinking positively enough. So you have to go back for even more to the same source. So it has this very nice built-in business model. Motivational seminars, you know, you feel, or many people who go feel really good for a couple of days afterwards. Then it fades because it was only a physiological thing. It wasn't really a massive breakthrough. So what do? Well, they feel like they need to go back to the next one.
So this leads you to take your readers into this lab at Harvard with a professor of psychology named Daniel Wegner, and he looks at this thing you call ironic process theory. What is that?
Well, Daniel Wegner's work is all about the idea of attempting to control your thoughts and to make your mind be filled with the content that you want it to be filled with. I should clarify, he was actually not someone whose lab I visited personally, but I write about him and visited a lot of labs. And the basic idea is that when we are stressed or tired or trying too hard, the effort to make sure you're not thinking negative thoughts, which is, of course, what you need to do if you're going to think positively, overcomes the positive thoughts. And all you can think about is trying not to have this negativity. And so negativity is all you're thinking about. It's a it's a very sort of tricky mechanism that seems to be omnipresent in how we approach emotional
But it's
life.
This idea that happiness is almost something you stumble on. It's very hard to put it out there as your goal.
Right, and this goes way back in philosophy, this idea that there's something about happiness that is you can only glimpse out of the corner of your eye. Or you look back and say, oh, I was happy yesterday. But when you try really hard to be happy, it seems to defeat the purpose, yeah.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we're talking with Oliver Berkman, author of The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. I want to ask you about how you're British. How would you situate America in terms of either the self-help industry or the kind of eternal quest for happiness? Would you say this has happened in America, but it's happening in France and Japan too? Or would you say, no, America is set apart here in a little bit of an island of trying to pursue happiness?
Well, it is something that is very fundamental to the American national myth, to the goals of the American founding documents. So I think it is a much bigger thing here. But self-help books like the ones I'm talking about sell in very large numbers all over the place. I don't think they actually sell as well in France, from what I've heard, but they do sell in many countries beyond the US. I think it has to do partly with the degree to which a national myth involves this idea that anybody can make it to the very pinnacle. In some other places, it's more to do with knowing that you can't fall to the very bottom because of, you know, a social safety net. So that is a difference between cultures. But I think really the urge is very universal, and I don't think the urge to want to be happy and successful is a bad thing at all. I just think the methods that are taught mainly are all back to front.
Well, let's talk about the difference then between modern and traditional societies. You talk a little bit about the scientist Gregory Bateson, who looked at traditional societies and sort of how they measure success in life. When we have more, are we happier? How do you compare, say, modern America with traditional Samoa or traditional Papua New Guinea, you know, places that have a very different structure of life?
Well, there's all sorts of differences, but I think the one that's interesting to focus on, especially in view of Brian Tracy, who's very much about goal setting and his whole big thing is that you should set very clear goals for your life, is that I think that some of those traditional cultures that don't choose a specific goal like economic growth to maximize at all costs, it's often a better way to be for happiness, because the problem with goal setting is you pick out one or a small number of aspects of your life or your society or your organization, and then you say, we're going to reach certain targets. And the problem is that in all sorts of ways you can't predict, you distort other parts of the life or the organization. So you pull on a couple of threads in the fabric and the whole thing gets really distorted out of shape. You know, we've all heard these stories of a company aiming for some very specific target in, say, revenue, and then it gets there even, but it only gets there at the cost of causing all this other damage to itself or its employees elsewhere in the company.
Are there keys? Does research show that there are certain things that tend to make people happier? Like, for example, does making more money make you a happier person?
The tradition, the sort of consensus, as I understand it, on that issue is that up to a certain threshold, yes, you absolutely, you know, it's good to have the money to cover essentials and to be fed and sheltered. It's after that, once you get into real wealth, financial wealth, that it doesn't make that much of a difference. That people, we are notoriously incredibly bad at predicting what it is that's going to make us happy. So there are famous studies about the weather, for example. People are completely convinced that if they move from a cold place to a warm place, they'd be much, much happier. But of course, they get there and find that they brought themselves with them. You know, it's the weather just, for most people, the weather just isn't that important.
Okay, let me go back to the money question. What is that cutoff point? Is there a point, you know, up which, yes, this makes a lot bigger difference, but the difference between, you know, $1 million and $3 million, that doesn't make a very big difference?
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me. I think it's around the sort of low five figures in dollars is an amount that is considered as an annual income that sort of cover. I think it was something, or it might have been pound sterling, actually, but it was around that kind of 20,000 point that the...
So we're talking maybe $50,000 a year, $50,000
a year. Right, I mean, these are good incomes on a global level. They are extraordinarily good incomes, but the point is that when you get into the stratosphere of wealth, when you get into that tiny number of people who have millions to play with, the extra does not add to their happiness in the way that you would predict. Yeah.
You also look at research in terms of getting a bigger house, getting a better car. Yeah. Do those things make a difference?
Again, all these studies are to do with people in aggregate. They may well make specific differences for specific people, but I think that what you generally get when you look at all the research, and again, these are global figures, so some of these will seem strange from an American, specifically American perspective or any other relatively privileged country. But what you find is that the things that we think will make us happy are not the things that make us happy. These things that bring certainty and security are not as happiness-inducing as we think they are. And the things that are actually much more to do with uncertainty and unpredictability, like meeting new people, experiences and travel where you don't know what's going to be involved, relationships that go through downs as well as ups. You know, these are the things that people look back on as being far more fulfilling, even though they're not in the same way so sort of predictable and steady state and wonderful in that kind of sense as you know, just having a wonderful house, having all the money you could possibly need. This is not doesn't seem to be how we're built when it comes to happiness.
I want to come back and talk about business and how this factors in actually to the financial crisis. We are talking about happiness, what it really is, and what it actually means to be happy. My guest is journalist Oliver Berkman, and his new book is The Antidote: Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. He will be at Brookline Booksmith tonight at 7 o'clock. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on Boston Public Radio.